From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Donald Trump is going after the parents of a fallen American soldier who made headlines for their critique of Trump at the Democratic National Convention. In Khuzir Khan's speech, he said Trump has sacrificed nothing and no one.
This week, a question hung in the air, one we've heard so many times before. Is this it? Could this be the end? Has Donald Trump finally crossed the line that will unravel his bid for the presidency?
How would you answer that, Father? What sacrifice have you made for your country?
I think I've made a lot of sacrifices. I work very, very hard. I've created thousands and thousands of jobs, tens of thousands of jobs, built great structures. I've had tremendous success. I think
those are sacrifices.
Oh, sure, I think they're sacrifices.
Trump has not stopped hitting back since, even though he's drawn intense fire from virtually all corners, including from prominent Republicans. We're going to dig deeper into the question of how far in his case is too far.
Seems like a salient question, except that we keep asking it and it keeps getting us nowhere. For the past year, or much longer if you want to begin with the birther nonsense, far too far has yet to be far enough.
Donald Trump on the defense after slamming John McCain's war record. Has Trump finally gone too far?
He's at it again, calling for a complete ban on Muslims entering the U.S. Has he gone just one step too far now?
Has he now gone too far with these comments about Meghan Kelly?
Well, you do see all these top Republicans now coming out in a way they haven't come out before.
As it turned out, sneering menstruation references, bans on an entire religion, and denigration of a war hero were not last straws for the sturdy camel's back of the Trump campaign, nor these Trumpruptions.
Has Donald Trump finally gone too far? Battling it out with Pope Francis over the border, Christianity, and the message he just posted about ISIS and the Vatican.
The Republican presidential frontrunner accused of mocking a reporter with a physical disability. Did he finally go too far?
Former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich found Trump's comments about the Mexican heritage of the judge presiding over the Trump University case too much to bear.
The shame just slides off as the press repeatedly expresses astonishment at Trump's Teflon exterior. But that's the wrong DuPont product. Trump isn't the Teflon candidate, he's the Kevlar candidate, impenetrably armored with the frustration and rage and applause of his supporters, which big media may not get, but Trump certainly does.
And everybody said, that's the end of Trump. It's over for Trump. You know how many times I've been given the end? I've been given the last rites. How many times? 10?
Of course, there's one segment of the media that absolutely does understand the dynamic. The right-wing media echo chamber, which has dutifully spun the straw of Trumpian outrage into the gold of incitement. The Khuzir Khan blowout is the latest example. Within 48 hours of his speech at the Democratic National Convention, conservative media outlets were busy turning the grieving victim into an enemy of the Republic. An article in Breitbart was headlined, Khuzir Khan's deep legal financial connections to Saudi Arabia, Hillary Clinton's foundation, tied terror, immigration, email scandals together. The Washington Examiner had a story by Paul Bedard claiming Khan specializes in visa programs accused of selling U.S. citizenship. The same story, nearly verbatim, appeared hours later in the Daily Caller, along with an article which featured the headline, Khuzir Khan has written extensively on Sharia law. A broadside on the blog Shubat.com accused Khan, a practicing U.S. lawyer, of being an agent of the Muslim Brotherhood. In short, a multi-front attack on the character of a man who would presume to criticize Donald Trump. Scott Greer is deputy editor at the Daily Caller. Scott, welcome to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
I want to call your attention to one of the recent headlines at the Daily Caller. Khuzir Khan has written extensively on Sharia law. As far as I can tell, it was one article when he was a law student in 1983. What does that bring to the table about our understanding of the Trump story?
I think it is relevant in the fact that now he's a public figure and he has brought up the fact that Donald Trump did not read the Constitution. And I think there's nothing wrong with bringing the fact that what he has written in the past on Sharia law, on Islamic law, is up for discussion at the moment.
Is there any mention in that 1983 Law Review article that he supports Sharia law as the law of the land for the United States or anything like that? Even a single line that would make it relevant to the contemporaneous discussion?
I think it is still relevant to see what his views on Islamic law are and how it applies to the Constitution. And he is very fervent in how Islamic law is relevant in the discussion today.
Unless I'm missing something, Scott, Kant's speech was meant to dramatize the idea that Muslim Americans and immigrants shouldn't be stereotyped as threats, and not least to compare patriotic sacrifice between what his son sacrificed, the ultimate, and what Trump has done for his country. And Trump's response to this was to question whether Kahn's speech was ghostwritten by Hillary's people, whether his wife standing next to him on stage was muzzled by the Quran, and then to claim that his work as a developer is somehow equivalent to the Kahn's sacrifice. Many people in both parties jumped on this as disrespectful. Institutionally, what did the Daily Caller think?
He never specifically mentioned that Mrs. Kahn was muscled by the Quran or by Islamic dictates. He merely asked, why didn't she speak? And I think that also brings out that we take a lot of what we think is the subtext of what Trump is saying, and then we apply to what we think he's saying.
On the subject of subtext, what are we to make of the story in the Daily Caller, father of Muslim U.S. soldier is attorney specializing in selling U.S. citizenship?
Yes, as a lawyer in his practice, he has specialized in giving out visas that could be threatened by Trump's immigration policies, and thus that creates a possible incentive for why Mr. Kahn would give a speech and be very opposed to Trump. It's a story that is of interest to the American public. We put it out there. It's something that they can interpret, and it is a possibility that if Trump's
Kahn's an immigration lawyer serving clients who wish to get legal status here using the applicable law to help them. Neither in your story nor anywhere else is there any evidence or any accusation whatsoever of him being implicated in any scandal or abuse of visa statutes. And by the way, if it becomes harder for a visa candidate to get a visa, then a lawyer's services become more, not less, in demand. Selling U.S. citizenship, that's essentially accusing him of committing a crime. I ask you the relevance.
We did not accuse him of engaging in any corruption or scandalous behavior. We merely point out what he did in his line of work, and we let the readers decide. We did not put out a declaration. This is why he is definitely opposed to Trump. We're just saying that, yes, it is a possibility that somebody who is specializes in immigration law and is dependent on easier access to these visas.
His son was blown to pieces while serving his army unit in Iraq.
Well, how does that deal with Trump? Is Trump responsible for his death?
These open-ended notions that invite readers to draw the most sinister conclusions. It sounds like the work of an opposition research team.
I don't think that us merely factually reporting what Mr. Kahn wrote in the 1980s about Islamic law, which is an important subject matter, is opposition research. And this is also a smear on a reporter who went out on his own, did his own research without any help of any kind of Trump campaign or anything to look at this information, and he found the article and he factually reported it.
There is a lot of feeding back and forth of Daily Caller and Breitbart and Washington Examiner and elsewhere in the so-called right-wing media ecosystem. The story about the visa programs was lifted almost verbatim from the Washington Examiner. It wasn't even your original work.
every media outlet reports the same stories if it is a breaking news story. At New York Times, not everything the New York Times wrote is something they broke. Not everything the Washington Post reports is something they broke. The same goes with NPR. This is something that was a breaking news story. We decided to post it on our website for our own audience because it is an important news story that would be of interest to our readers and to the general public to know. It's not some great, vast right-wing conspiracy going around, passing these articles around just to smear the Khan family.
If not that, then what?
We're reporting the news. This is news.
But it strikes me that losing your son in the line of duty while fighting for his country is ample motivation for Mr. Khan to want to speak to the place of immigrants and second-generation Americans in our way of life, that a Muslim American is exactly as patriotic as anybody else and makes exactly the same sacrifices that white Christian soldiers make.
Well, that's actually funny you bring that up. Muslim Americans make up 1% of the population. There are about 3.3 million of this country. Muslims make up less than 0.3% of the current armed forces that we have. And in terms of casualties and fatalities, since 9/11, they make up a little over 0.2%. On the contrary, white, mostly Christian, make up 71% of our current armed forces, yet they're only 62% of our population at the moment. And whites make up over 83% of the fatalities since 9/11 for our armed forces. It's nice to bash white Americans for some reason, but we have to look at the statistics for proportionality if we're going to make this argument.
Bash white Americans. Are you suggesting then that contrary to Mr. Khan's point, that in fact Muslim Americans are not as patriotic as, let's just say, white Christians? Why trot out those numbers?
Well, the impression you're making is that Muslim Americans are just as patriotic or more patriotic than white Christians. And if you're going to rely on statistics for that, if you're going to go and who's represented in the armed forces at the moment, if you look at the
what
statistics
unit did you
and the demographics,
serve in?
I did not serve.
Why are you trying to question the motives and discredit the father of this lost soldier? Why?
This is a public figure. He is going on issues that are not relating to his son's death. This is him attacking Trump. He specializes in immigration law. He makes money off it. And it is nothing wrong with reporting that. That is serious news. I think that's much more newsworthy than us worshiping Tim Kaine like most of these mainstream media outlets are, or how he's America's stepdad. And I do think that this is serious news that we should look into. This is his background. I don't think there's anything wrong with reporting on a public figure's background who is the top news story of the week.
Okay. Well, Scott, thank you so much. I appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you.
Scott Greer is deputy editor at the Daily Caller. Coming up, should you vote from the heart or from the head?
You know, people are critical of the term lesser evil. Well, you just want us to vote for the lesser evil. Of course we do, because you want less evil in the world.
This is On the Media.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. And so now, after a vicious year of primaries, caucuses, debates, and drama, and the winnowing of 20-some contenders, now we are down to two, each facing off for the final prize with their parties, unified as one, behind them. Just kidding.
A leaked email scandal rocking the Democratic Party, taking down the head of the DNC. Chaos and a cascade of boos as the convention begins.
Chaos at the convention proves again the party's divided, proves Donald Trump cannot control the Republicans.
Researchers say Harry Potter's arch-villain Lord Voldemort has a more favorable rating among young adults than both the leading presidential candidates.
On the right, the Republican Party, in a mad rush to contain a nominee who seems intent on sabotaging his own candidacy by insulting everything that moves, including babies and the party's leaders. On the left, a different anxiety has taken hold, not about an out-of-control candidate, but about corralling a restive base.
Some Bernie Sanders supporters still vowing to never vote for Hillary.
I'm telling you, Jill Stein's looking a heck of a lot better than those Bernie Sanders supporters right now.
Green Party candidate for president, Dr. Jill Stein, made an appeal to the group of Bernie Sanders supporters who still aren't sold on Hillary Clinton.
To any Democrat who would bypass Clinton, the party's message is clear.
Based on her ideas and her leadership, Hillary Clinton must become the next president of the United States.
Now, only 13% of Sanders supporters claim to be mulling a vote for Green Party candidate Jill Stein, and she's polling at only 5% nationwide. But this does not reassure Democrats who remember the election of 2000, when history was determined by a paltry 537 votes, and blame was assigned to a man whose name is now synonymous in many circles with spoiler.
We can't afford, you know, almost like a Ralph Nader situation. When the Democrat liberals split off, we can have a disastrous result.
You're going to have Jill Stein. She could be the Ralph Nader of this election if it becomes real close.
Bernie Sanders has said if he's not the nominee, he's going to make absolutely sure we don't end up with a situation like we did with Ralph Nader, where essentially we handed over an election to a Republican who put our nation way off track, that the nation can't afford that.
So the Democratic Party frets and the media speculate. Will the Bernie bros fall in line behind the anointed candidate? Or will they cut off their noses to spite the status quo and cast crucial votes for the no-chance Green Party? Or is there perhaps another way? Nathan J. Robinson is editor-in-chief of the progressive political magazine Current Affairs. Robinson is a staunch Clinton critic and Sanders booster, but he doesn't believe that he has to compromise on either of those things when he pulls the lever for Clinton in November. Nathan, welcome to OTM.
Good to be here.
You and your publication are consistently critical of the Democratic establishment and of the Clintons in particular, and you've written very favorably about Bernie. You even wrote in February that only he could beat Donald Trump in a general election. And yet, 2 weeks before the Democratic National Convention, you wrote a piece arguing that many leftists, such as yourself, should in fact vote for Hillary Clinton. Explain to me why that is not a sellout.
So the main thing I'm saying is not actually that most Democrats who are critical of Clinton should vote for Clinton. The basic premise of the argument is that we should think about voting differently. The way I think of voting is that you should think about the potential consequences of your vote. That's the most important thing. Voting isn't necessarily a way to say who you are and what you care about. It's something that has consequences. So actually, for the vast majority of people who live in 40-some-odd states who are critical of Clinton on the left, they can go ahead and vote for third party because it doesn't make a difference.
But you're saying if you live in Pennsylvania or Ohio or in right. Virginia or other states deemed to be battleground states, you've got to think about the resource that is your vote and how best to deploy it.
Right. Because there could be consequences to what you do. If 500 Nader voters in Florida had changed their mind, we probably wouldn't have had the Iraq War. So I think those consequences are the most important thing. You know, people are critical of the term lesser evil. Well, you just want us to vote for the lesser evil. Of course we do, because you want less evil in the world. You don't have to diminish at all or trivialize how critical you are of the Clintons. Like, I think they're everything that's wrong with American politics and what have you. The only question is it less or is it more? And in the situation of Trump, the questions people are asking is, does this threaten to end the species, right? If someone's talking freely about nuclear war, someone that unhinged and has that much access to power, it's a very, very dangerous situation. It's obviously worse than the threat the Clintons pose.
Now, I want to talk to you about standing by your principles. I could keep you on the line for hours with the argument that a principled vote for what I believe in should not be sacrificed for something so soiled as pragmatic politics. Am I wrong?
Well, see, this is the thing, is I think this has a very strange and sort of romantic conception of what voting is, where voting is the way that we express our innermost identities and we declare who we are and what we stand for. I don't think of voting that way. I think of voting as something that you do 5 minutes one day of the year, and that most political action and most expression of your moral convictions should occur elsewhere in other realms. Voting is just about the consequences. And the other point is, I don't think of pragmatism as the compromise of your values. Being pragmatic is an enactment of your values. Your values are that you care about what you do in the world. This approach to voting, the strategic approach, doesn't require you to stop being critical, because what you say is, look, on election day, clearly I'm going to keep Trump out of office, but in the meantime, I don't have to keep silent because my vote is strategic. It's not a full endorsement and it doesn't diminish the force of my criticisms.
All right. Well, this gets to something you were alluding to earlier, and that is whether the presidential election every 4 years is really the place for these protests to be taking place.
Yeah, that's what I actually object to the most. I think we overinvest ourselves in the moral significance of our presidential election ballot, and we agonize over it as if that's the way to say who we are. Democrats have lost half of their governorships. They're doing very badly in Congress and at the state level and at the local level. And it's really important to fight those fights. And yet we put all of our time into thinking about the presidential election and what does it say if we vote for Jill Stein, or what does it say if we vote for Hillary Clinton. I think it's a decision that should take you 5 minutes. And then the rest of the year, get on with other things that have political consequence and meaning for people.
Meanwhile, for the last 25 years, with a lot of Koch brother money, the Republicans have been locking up state legislatures and governorships, creating an almost invulnerable majority in the House of Representatives where they can actually, you know, pass laws.
Yeah, the Republicans know what they're doing. If the left is serious about pursuing their goals, they should adopt those tactics instead of having an internal argument over whether they should vote for Jill Stein, even though the only possible consequence of that argument is that the Green Party goes from 2% to 4%. It's possible that you could pull the Democrats to the left, but I think really what happens when you show that you can throw the election is they move to the right and they try and pick up Republican voters, which is what Hillary Clinton's doing. She's seeking to pick up moderate and conservative voters. So instead of that, they should be strategizing about how do we get progressive policies passed at every level of government? How do we challenge moderate and right-wing Democratic incumbents? How do we get our agenda enacted in the real world rather than this very, very abstract notion of how you express your principles?
I guess the media have to take some of the blame, because every 4 years, nothing else exists but the presidential race.
Right.
And for the rest of those 4 years, there is zero attention paid to any of the things we've just been discussing.
Well, it's hard to tell the media what to do because of the kind of institutions they are, because of the incentives they have. I mean, what they say when you confront them with this and you say, well, don't you have an obligation to try and help people become more informed, is, well, we have an obligation to give our viewers what they want. And if you put a discussion of economics and local governance on CNN at night, nobody will watch. And they are probably right in that respect. So you're kind of asking them to do something that as profit-making institutions, the national media, can't really do. Now, there are people like the New York Times, for example, who do position themselves as a more dispassionate and intellectual, if you will, publication that I actually do think are failing their responsibilities. Because if you go on their website, you see so many stories about the national election and they don't really have to do it. And I think they need to be called out on it and told, look, if you don't think people are reading stories about local governance, it's probably because you're not telling them very interestingly.
Nathan, thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Nathan J. Robinson is editor-in-chief of Current Affairs magazine. Robinson's vision of strategic voting is more personal principle than a national strategy. But what if we actually had one of those? What would strategic voting look like, scaled up to encompass an entire nation of voters trying to enact change? If only there were a similar country that had actually devised and executed a plan for strategic voting. Oh, wait! There is! It's a strange and distant land called Canada, where the optimizers optimized as recently as 2015, and they got results. Hisham Abdulrahman is the founder of the Strategic Voting Project in Canada. Hisham, welcome to On the Media.
Hello, Bob.
Let's begin with the difference between the Canadian system and the U.S. system. Instead of two major parties battling it out, you have multiple parties, and the winner is the one who polls the most, often a very small plurality among many, correct?
Yeah, that's true. We have a few parties in Canada, and all of them are competing for 338 seats in the parliament. And whichever party actually had more seats will govern. Doesn't have to be a majority. It can easily create a minority government.
And if there's more parties on one side of the political spectrum, in this case, the political left, and fewer parties on the opposite side of the spectrum, in Canada's case, really the one conservative party, that gives a structural advantage to the political right. When did that start being an issue in Canada?
It started in 2003. 2003, we have two parties on the right, and those two parties merged and created the new Conservative Party of Canada. At the same time, the three parties on the left stayed the way they are. And in 2006 election, the Conservatives start winning election with around 37% of the vote. And the other three progressive parties get 63% with no saying in how the country actually run.
So all you have to do is change the rules to create a proportionate representation, except that's not going to happen. Why?
Under the Conservative government, they totally understand that proportional representation will actually end their possibility of governing the country. So this solution is actually a no-go for them, because in Canada, at least right now, we have 66% of the voters are progressive. Having a majority between them, they can make a coalition. So what we have to do in Canada is to elect one of those progressive parties that promise to change the system so that they actually can implement what they have promised the electorate.
So if you're on the left, this is a vicious cycle. You need a progressive government to change the rules, but under the current rules, you can never achieve a progressive government unless you employ strategic voting. How does that work, and what did you accomplish?
So we looked at electoral districts where actually a majority of the voter voted for a progressive candidate and they end up with a conservative one. And try to tell those voters that if you want really to make a difference, you have to vote for candidate A of the progressive candidate. And please forget about candidate B, because if you divided your vote between those two candidates, you will end up with none. So for somebody in Hamilton, they will go to the website and click on the right province, and from there they will find the recommendation.
Now, I can see how if you're a candidate, I might be miffed because I see myself as an individual candidate with an individual set of values and beliefs, and, you know, who are these carpetbaggers to tell my constituents not to vote for me?
In Canada, I said we have four different parties, three on the left and one on the right, and when you recommend one party, you're going to get three people mad. And I got my fair share. We are trying to fix a system that is actually broken. When the majority in a certain district is selecting left-leaning candidates and end up with somebody on the right representing them in every single election, then there's something wrong with the system. If the system was equitable enough, was fair enough, we wouldn't have to do any of that.
So lo and behold, 2015 elections, Stephen Harper and the Conservatives are kicked out. The left parties win a majority in Parliament. Justin Trudeau is the Prime Minister. Are you accepting congratulations for this?
Justin Trudeau represents more of Canada than the previous Conservative government, for sure. And I absolutely attribute part of it to strategic voting. Hopefully, Justin Trudeau will pass some sort of proportional representation system and we don't have to go through this route again anymore.
Now, the occasion for this conversation is our own forthcoming elections, where there are, of course, two major dominant parties, but also one or two minor parties, notably Jill Stein of the Green Party, who at least theoretically could swing the election one way or the other. How would we take the principles of strategic voting to make sure that votes aren't squandered in November here in the States?
Doing a swab within the progressive bloc, where voters who would vote for Clinton in the red states can vote instead for Dr. Jill Stein, and voters on the swing and blue states who will vote for Jill Stein will vote for Clinton, that will give the Green Party the votes to represent themselves as a bigger movement. And in the meantime, will ensure that all progressives are voting as one block in those swing states where the votes are going to be very precious this election cycle for sure.
So to take the votes in the battleground states and push them towards Hillary Clinton, and at the same time, in the states where the Democrats have no chance, for progressives to vote for the Green Party to make the Green Party more sustainable in the future as a sort of viable third-party option.
Exactly. In the last election, President Obama received 18 million votes in those 22 red states. Those 18 million votes did not produce one electoral college vote for him. So deploying those to vote for Dr. Stein, in the meantime, getting Dr. Stein supporters in those swing states to vote for Senator Clinton will actually achieve only good for the greater progressive movement in the United States.
So it's like taking slag from the steelmaking process. You know, it's useless waste, but you use it to build roads. You're taking waste votes and using them to build democracy. Eh?
Exactly. Those votes are of no concern for Clinton campaign at all, but they are totally crucial for the Green Party and Dr. Stein to establish this viable option. That actually, the Democrats actually need this movement. I'll quote you three different presidents in the United States talking to three different generations. I start with FDR. FDR was talking to Sidney Hillman, a labor leader. FDR said to Sidney, I agree with everything in your proposal. Now you just go back home and make me do it. Lyndon B. Johnson actually have a similar thing talking to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. when Dr. Martin Luther King was trying to push the Civil Rights Act. He said, you go out there, Dr. King, and keep doing what you are doing and make it possible for me to do the right thing. And similar quote from President Obama in a 2009 environmental event. He said, show me the movement, make me do it. So three different American presidents, all of them asking for the movement that will keep them to their promises. And having a third viable alternative all the time there will lit a fire under the Democrats to do the right thing to their voters.
And perhaps we'll make America great again.
America is great.
All right, Hisham, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, Bob.
Hisham Abdulrahman is the founder of Canada's Strategic Voting Project, which can be found at strategicvoting.ca. Coming up, the man who changed history, or maybe didn't, Mr. Spoily McSpoiler.
We don't allow small parties to have a chance to compete. I mean, what if nature wouldn't allow seeds to sprout?
This is On the Media.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. As we've heard, most Americans who fear or loathe Donald Trump don't want to find themselves with a Ralph Nader debacle on their hands. His determination to put the Green Party on the electoral map is widely blamed for Al Gore's 537-vote loss in Florida to George W. Bush in 2000. If Nader's thousands of progressive votes had gone to liberal Gore, Gore would have won the presidency. No George W. Bush, no ruinous Iraq War, no ISIS. If. The thing is, it might be baloney. Tony Shinella is an editor and journalist at Patch.com in New Hampshire. As a 2000 Nader staffer, he's not keen on seeing the George W. Bush presidency being blamed on his man. But he's also, as they say, done the math. Tony, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me why Ralph Nader is not, in fact, responsible for the George W. Bush regime.
We don't know what voters in Florida would have done if Nader was not on the ballot. But this is what's so astounding. Registered Democrats, 13% of them voted for Bush. People who said that they voted for Bill Clinton in 1996, 16% of them voted for Bush.
I can't argue with your conclusion that Gore did a crummy job all by himself, failing to hold the base that had been established by President Clinton into Florida wins. But what is at issue is what would have happened if Nader weren't in the race.
So you can't just automatically say every Nader voter or even 45% of Nader voters in Florida were leftist Bernie Sanders people. The numbers are actually the opposite of that. Nader took 4% of the independent vote and equal numbers, 1% of both Republicans and Democrats, registered party members. So in other words, of those registered Democrats and Republicans, they would have separated almost equally if Nader was not on the ballot. Look at the Perot voters. 10% of Perot voters in the exit poll in Florida voted for Nader. Perot voters in the results from 2000 were going almost 2.5 to 1 for Bush. CNN actually did an exit poll asking people in Florida, if there were only two candidates, who would you vote for? Bush received 49% of the Florida tabulation. Gore received 47%, and 2% said they wouldn't have voted. Even then, Bush has a 2-point lead.
Your piece looked at just about every permutation that has been forwarded about how the Nader vote would have split absent Nader's name on the ballot. And they all came out, as you're saying now, where George W. Bush still wins Florida, if he actually indeed won Florida. But in what way could you be wrong? Could you have this wrong?
Oh, yeah, I could have this wrong. And I can tell you from my own personal experience, because most of my family lives in between Miami and Key Largo, it's a totally mixed bag. There were pro-lifers who were voting for Nader in that race. I know them. They told me they were voting for Nader. But there are also hippy-dippy leftist Democrats. Knowing that, as well as knowing that one of Nader's other best counties other than Monroe was Gainesville, which is where the University of Florida is, there probably are 537 votes in Gainesville and Monroe County, say 538, that would have gone to Al Gore if Nader had not been in the race. So I've analyzed my own analysis and come up with the opposite of what I truly believe with the data, because I know personally voters in those areas, and I know what the turnout was. And Florida is crazy because it was essentially a tie. I mean, you can't cast millions of votes and have one person be selected with 537 win. I mean, it's the closest we've ever seen.
Knowing what you know about third-party votes and their dynamics, if you had your 2000 vote back, would you cast it for Ralph Nader?
If it were August 2000 again and I knew what I know now, I would have worked harder for Ralph Nader because I truly believe that we should have more than two political parties. And that was what the end result of the campaign was supposed to be, was getting the Green Party to 5% so it could be a national party. I won't change that about myself. I think that you can look at some things, including the Iraq War, which you mentioned before, and say that may not have happened. It probably would have happened, but not the way it did turn out. If you look at the Patriot Act votes, if you look at the authorization to go into Afghanistan, all of those things were voted by almost all of the Democrats at the time. Would it actually have happened the way that it all panned out? Maybe, maybe not. But I look at the missed opportunity that 2000 had. Many people were scared into abandoning Ralph Nader and the creation of a Green Party because the goal wasn't just to support Ralph Nader. It was also to establish the Greens as a national party with 5%. That is the missed moment. And everybody, again, we see in 2016 are saying to all of the Bernie Sanders voters, you're just going to have to wait for the reforms and you've got to come along and vote for Hillary Clinton. And they're saying the same thing on the other side. You got to support Trump because you all promised to support the GOP nominee. The scaring, people have a choice to do what they want with their votes. And if they want to vote for Jill Stein and they want to vote for Gary Johnson, they should do that regardless of what happens. That's their right. The only wasted vote is one that isn't cast. But don't allow yourself to be scared to do what you want to do with your vote.
Tony, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Tony Shinella is an editor and journalist at Patch.com, speaking from Concord, New Hampshire. For 16 years, not an election has gone by without Nader's name being invoked as the father of tragic folly, the spoiler of all spoilers, and the begetter of the George W. Bush presidency. Well, to paraphrase Woody Allen in Annie Hall, I happen to have Ralph Nader right here.
You know nothing of my work.
Nice. Yes, Nader is fed up with the conventional wisdom, and he thinks his media scolds should be looking at their own culpability for a system that gave us 2000 and our current melodrama as well. Ralph, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Bob.
Now, I vividly remember around 2001 or 2002 drunkenly approaching you at some Washington event and jabbing my finger into your chest and saying, thanks for nothing. And you patiently explained to me why the Bush-Cheney administration and all that came from it wasn't your fault. And I believe I walked away satisfied. Would you be kind enough to satisfy me once again?
Why is the Green Party the scapegoat for the Democratic Party's failure to defeat a bumbling governor from Texas who couldn't put a paragraph together and who had a horrible record on children, on pollution, on corporate welfare? And all the shenanigans in Florida with Jeb Bush and the Secretary of State in Tallahassee, the Green Party's responsible for that? The loss of thousands of votes for Gore by the misidentification of ex-felons, the 5-4 decision by the Supreme Court, blocking the Florida Supreme Court's ongoing full state recount, which would have given the state to Gore. He lost his home state of Tennessee. That alone would have put him in the White House. He lost Arkansas, Clinton's home state. That alone would have put him in the White House. It's just a matter of massive scapegoating by the Democratic Party against the little Green Party that dared to try to make the national presidential campaign a little more competitive by injecting a dozen issues of change in this country that actually had majoritarian support.
Let's pull back further, because you believe that the problem isn't the mischief created by third parties. It's that third parties are so marginalized in our system to begin with.
We have an equal right to run for election in this country. We have an equal right to try to get votes from one another. So we're either all spoilers of one another or none of us are spoilers. I mean, the word spoiler is a politically bigoted word only reserved for third-party challengers.
Why is it bigotry?
Because they treat third parties like second-class citizens. Instead of welcome injections and new agendas, new leaders, new energies, new vote turnout, historically, the third parties in our country blazed the way for most of the major progressive achievements of the United States of America. The Little Liberty Party in 1840 against slavery, women's suffrage parties. It was Eugene Debs that put on the table full health insurance, Social Security, put on the table a progressive income tax, the 40-hour week. None of them won a national election or came close, but they put it on the table and got a lot of public discussion until the one or more of the two major parties picked it up. So why are we treating third parties this way, with huge ballot access obstacles, harassing litigation, keeping them off the presidential debate?
We started this conversation with me jabbing a finger in your chest. Why don't you jab one into mine? Tell me how my industry, media have been aiders and abettors in the kind of suppression you're describing?
The mass media is pretty disgraceful, because they basically say, what are the polls for these candidates? How much money these candidates have? So if you start out with a modest amount of money and you're not high in the polls, they won't give you coverage. And they won't give you coverage, you don't get higher in the polls. The problem is that the polling companies are owned by the very mass media that ignores you. And so the only way you can reach tens of millions of people as a third-party candidate, unless you're very rich, is to get on the presidential debates. I traveled in 2000 to 50 states. I spoke to by far the largest gatherings, filled Madison Square Garden, the Boston Garden, the Target Center in Minnesota. And I figured out I had reached only 2% of the number of people I would have reached had I been on that stage for just one of the three debates between Bush and Gore.
Well, you know, had you considered appearing on Dancing with the Stars?
I tried everything. I did get on, I think, one or two of the nightly national comedy shows. It's absurd. You're trying to discuss serious turnarounds for the United States, its impact on the world, with a few minutes in highly saturated, pseudo-comedic context. And the tragedy is that when we filled Madison Square Garden, we got a little article in the New York Times on the obituary page.
I read a piece you did in the LA Times back in June laying out all of these arguments. Where I believe your argument falls down is that you pointed us instead towards the European parliamentary system where there's proportional representation. And I think you were saying, yeah, let's do it like that. Except we're not like that. That's not how the American democracy is constructed. So short of entirely changing one of the three branches of government, how does any of this get fixed?
Well, one way is there should be one federal ballot access standard, and it should be much lower than the many different state ballot access standards that are often abusively interpreted, and you think you meet all the petition signature levels, and then some party functionary can disregard it, as happened in Pennsylvania. So let's have one federal ballot access standard. The second is they can have instant runoff voting, which operates in places like San Francisco, where you basically vote your first choice, second, third, and the first choice doesn't win, your second choice triggers in. So nobody can win an election without getting a majority. That's an easy way to get rid of the so-called spoiler nonsense. And the third is the press has got to do its job. The media is horribly imitative of one another. They emphasize tactics and strategies and endless speculation. They interview each other. They don't bring in the civic community that knows a lot about these issues and can broaden the agenda and correct the fabrications or mistakes of the candidates. The media's performance is abysmal.
This sequence of interviews we're doing is premised mostly on the notion that Jill Stein and your Green Party could siphon votes off of Hillary Clinton and create a true national catastrophe of a Donald Trump presidency.
Not a chance. First of all, it's balanced out by the Libertarian Party on the other side, which probably will get more votes. Second, it's interesting, Bob, you never use the word siphon when it comes to the two major parties. I mean, do you ever hear any reporters say, I wonder how many votes Trump is going to siphon from Hillary? There's something illegitimate about that word siphon.
Because the decision on whom to pull the lever for is actually fundamental, and it isn't sneaking gasoline from your neighbor's tank in the dark of night.
Yeah, and I think the voters want more choices, more voices. The polls show they want a viable third party. I think one reason we're not getting a higher vote total, as in some European countries, is that we don't have a multi-party system. We don't allow small parties to have a chance to compete. I mean, what if nature wouldn't allow seeds to sprout? What if big business wouldn't allow small business a chance to get a toehold and compete? But when it comes to politics, it's just Pepsi and Coke. Democrat, Republican, getting more and more alike.
Well, Dr. Pepper, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob Garfield.
Ralph Nader is a consumer advocate, political activist, and author of Unstoppable, the emerging left-right alliance to dismantle the corporate state, and the forthcoming Breaking Through Power. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Meera Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, and Jesse Brenneman. We had more help from Micah Lowinger, Sarah Kari, Emma Stelder, and Isabel Christo. This is our farewell to Emma and Isabel, brilliant and charming both, whose stints here are sadly at an end. Ladies, we will miss you. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Holford. Katu Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
I happen to have Mr. McLuhan right here. Come over here a second.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. You mean my whole fallacy is wrong. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Boy, if life were only like this.
Support for On the Media comes from the Overbrook Foundation and the listeners of WNYC Radio.